So from the time I was a child, I had an uncanny awareness. I always knew that I was different, but I didn't understand why. At school, I had a hard time with other kids, playing games, laughing, horsing around dolls. None of that stuff ever appealed to me. I thought it was quite silly, actually. I was much more comfortable being outside. I had horses, dogs, all kinds of animals, an amazing garden. I was much more happy being by myself. As a result, I was the last kid picked for teams. I never had invitations to birthday parties. But in eighth grade, I had two amazing teachers. And those two guys, they changed my life. They believed in me. They nurtured my creativity. They praised my love for science. And the confidence that they gave in me made me believe in myself as I embarked on what would become a lifelong journey of creative exploration of the natural world. When I was in college, I figured out exactly what that journey would entail. I always loved earth science, but I was a biology major. And because of my love for earth science, every elective I took had to do with either geology or the ocean. My junior year, I took an oceanography course. It was taught by a professor named Conrad Newman. Conrad Newman is one of the most amazing people that I've ever known. He was a tall New Englander, lanky, funny, hilarious accent, engaging, an absolutely incredible storyteller. Conrad brought the ocean to life, and he did it through a lens of geology, which just fascinated and amazed me. Every lecture that he gave was like an adventure story sprinkled with nuggets of information that we needed to learn to pass the exam. He introduced me to my passion, and I poured myself completely into it. When I was a graduate student, I worked in a lab just up the road from here in Tomales Bay, California. One day, late in the day, I was in the lab all by myself. It was completely deserted. That was my favorite way to work. That particular day, everybody was down the hill at a wine and cheese cocktail party celebrating the opening of a new facility. I was up in the lab staring at a bucket of water and a little glass rod with sensitive electronics looking in the middle of it. That little glass rod was called a microelectrode. I'm going to break the rule and teach them something. These little microelectrodes, they're incredibly delicate. If you stare at them hard, they break into pieces, which I was very good at breaking them. So as I was working, staring at my little bucket of water as I had been for the past few hours, all of a sudden, I knew that somebody was headed up the hill. How did I know? I could see his footsteps as pressure waves on the bucket of water, and I became more and more irritated as I thought to myself, oh my God, I'm 4 hours in. I only have 10 minutes to go. Who is this person who's coming up the hill? So it turned out to be a reporter who I didn't know him. But I knew he was coming before he said a word. He showed up. He started asking questions. He didn't ask if he could come in, so I didn't bother to look up at him. I stared at my bucket of water. I continued making my measurements, looking through my microscope intently, hoping that if I ignored him, if I was rude enough, that he would just go away and leave me alone. But he didn't. He was very persistent. He continued asking me questions, and I continued giving him answers. Still, eventually, I gave up, and I looked up at him, and I was like, oh, God, why are you here? And then I noticed he had a notepad. He had been taking notes. That's when I realized that he was, I don't think I realized he was a reporter, but he was taking notes, and I hadn't expected that. It kind of surprised me. So I stood up, and I walked away from the microscope, and he walked over to it, which terrified me a little bit because I thought he was going to break my electrode. He didn't. It was okay. But he took a peek through. And when he took a peek through, he was like, wow, that's really cool. And I said, well, of course it's cool. I know that. And then he had a lot more questions, which I happily answered because I love everything microbial and I could talk for days about it. So I told him all about the cyanobacteria and the purple sulfur bacteria and these little microbial mats that these organisms built, that studying them provided a window into early Earth history, the Archean world. These little organisms that I was studying, they built the atmosphere of early Earth. They shaped the geosphere. They changed the evolution of the planet. So they were pretty superhero-like to me. Anyway, when we were done, I realized that this was a pretty cool thing. He wrote a story about me that was on the Sunday science page of the San Francisco Chronicle. It kind of made my mom think that being an oceanographer was okay. She thought I was a little crazy there for a while, but then I was on the newspaper and she thought I was cool. So what it did for me though, was it taught me that, you know, some random person coming up to you, you tell them a story, they listen, they write another story, and then people are paying attention to what you're doing. It ignited a passion for me for science education and outreach. So how did I get into the Gulf of Mexico? That's a funny story too. So when I was a postdoc in 1994, I went to an ASLO meeting, which is a society like AGU. When I go to these meetings, I always spend one day going to sessions that I know absolutely nothing about because I want to learn new things when I come to meetings. So that day I went to a session on deep sea chemosynthetic ecosystems, which sounded pretty cool. I had heard about them cursorily, but I didn't know anything about them. After the session, I was blown away and I walked up to this woman and I started just peppering her with questions. What is this? What is that? How do you do that? How do you do that? And she just at one point started shaking her head. She said, you know, you ask really good questions. You seem kind of smart. And I need to take a microbiologist on my next expedition. Do you think you would like to come? Before she even finished telling me the details of the expedition, I started jumping up and down. It was embarrassing in hindsight. I think I squealed. And I was like, yes, of course. Yes, yes, yes. I would love to come. I would love to come. So 6 months later, I joined her on the research vessel Seward Johnson in Fouchon, Louisiana, a place I had never been to before, but I ended up visiting many, many times over the next decade. And we sailed off into the Gulf of Mexico to do some exploration. A few days into the expedition, I climbed into the coffin of the Johnson Sea-Link submersible. It's called a coffin because it's about that size. It's dark and it's cold, but inside, once you enter, it is electric and it's magical. About 30 minutes later, we were close to the bottom, and I had already been mind blown. My jaw was just stuck to the floor. My eyeballs had popped out, and I was looking for them. I was mind blown by the bioluminescence that we had seen on the way down to the bottom. It was just like a fireworks show, but it was in the ocean. It was in the water column. It was in the dark, and I had never seen anything like it. But then he turned the lights on, and what I saw in front of me was unlike anything I had ever even imagined existed on this planet. It was this little pool of salty water, really, really, really super salty water on the bottom of the ocean. And it was surreal because it was the most spectacular cobalt blue color that I had ever seen anywhere. I mean, I can't even describe the color of blue because I don't think they make a crayon that's that color. But it was cobalt blue, and it was surrounded by a thick rim of mussels about 2 meters wide. And then swimming along the top of this brine were these hagfish that just looked like some prehistoric creature out of a mystery book or something, swimming and diving down into this brine and then, you know, having osmotic shock and halfway dying. But it was just incredible. And I thought to myself, I was like, oh my God, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to be in a submarine, exploring the bottom of the ocean, seeing things that are unreal, being the first person to see things. I want to discover things. I knew that's what I was going to do for the rest of my career. I spent the next 15 years doing just that in the Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico, for me, is a very, very special place. It's taught me a lot as an ecosystem. And on April 21st, 2010, I got a phone call. Actually, it was an email, sorry, from a friend of mine who was out on the Pelican, another research vessel, working at a site that was just upslope from the Deepwater Horizon site, MC-252. She sent me this email and she said, Mandy, something is going on out here. There's all this smoke. Can you do some digging and try to figure out what it is and let us know? I said, okay. So I started doing what everybody does. I Googled and eventually I figured out what was going on. The Deepwater Horizon had suffered a catastrophic blowout and the rig was on fire and it was burning. And they eventually got chased away. But in that moment, I engaged in the academic response to the oil spill. I felt like we, the Gulf science community, had a lot to offer. We had been working in the system, most of us for at least a decade, some for 20 or 30 years, and we really wanted to step up and help and do something to contribute to the response. So I got involved. But I never, ever imagined being in the middle of the media blitz during the oil spill. And that happened because I got annoyed with a reporter again. I don't think I'll do it a third time. I think two is enough. This time it was Justin Gillis of the New York Times. Justin had written a column about scientists in the Gulf of Mexico not doing enough in response to the oil spill. He was chastising the scientific community, and he hadn't called me. I called a few friends. He hadn't called any of them. And then I got really more irritated, and I didn't really know what I was going to do. I thought about it. I talked to five or six people. Everybody was like, I don't know. This is very, I don't know what he's thinking. So I did something I've never done before. Well, I've Googled, but I Googled his phone number. I practiced in my head what I was going to say in the 2-minute message that would be his voicemail when he didn't answer his phone. And I called. I called him. The only problem was he answered the phone. I really wasn't prepared for him to answer the phone. I remember going, oh, God. Except I didn't say that out loud. I thought it to myself. And then I didn't even introduce myself. I don't remember saying hello. And he doesn't remember me saying hello either. We're friends now, but we weren't then. So I just lit into him. I mean, I lit into him like I have never lit into anybody. In hindsight, I feel really sorry for him, the way that I lit into him. But I told him how irresponsible he was. I told him it was offensive. I pointed, I had a list of all the things he had done wrong. I just went off. And he let me. He didn't interrupt me. He didn't say a word. When I was done, I was like, oh my God. And he said, are you done? And I said, I think I'm done. And he said, okay, fair enough. So tell me what you actually are finding. And I said, okay. And I told him. I told him about our current results. I told him what we thought they meant. I told him that it was all preliminary. And I told him that he really needed to talk to Vernon and Arna, the two people who were out on the water on the Pelican. And I was just unsure. So he called them. He called me again. And then he said, he sent me this message. He said, I'm going dark. I didn't know what that meant. But I was like, wow, this is a spy novel. So he went dark. And then at 11:50, I got a text saying the story's going up. And I was like, what does that mean? I mean, I didn't know any. I had no clue what was going on. So the story went up online at about 12 o'clock. And my phone started ringing at 12:10. And it didn't stop ringing until I unplugged it 4 hours later. And then I checked my email, and I had 400 emails. And then I went, oh, my God, what have I done? I couldn't go into my office because there were media trucks parked outside. I had to actually buy big giant glasses, dark sunglasses, and a hat, you know, like Britney Spears. And I had to walk around and sneak into my office to avoid reporters. It was cool. It lasted a week. It actually was horrible because I was thinking, what in the world have I done? And the crazy part of it was that I was totally unprepared. Nobody ever trains you for that. I was terrible. I was so naive. I answered questions that I shouldn't have answered. I did a lot of stupid things. I was quite gullible. But eventually, I found my footing. And I got out of there and out on the water about a week later. I led the first of many expeditions in response to the oil spill. And I brought Justin Gillis out with me on that cruise. Doing the research was hard enough. It was really not something that you're prepared for as an oceanographer to do that kind of work. But the media firestorm, oh my God, it was bananas. These reporters were crazy, like rabid dogs after you with questions. I had a guy actually jump off a dock once while the ship was still moving, coming in to tie up, onto the vessel so he could be the first one to ask me a question. Luckily, he didn't fall off. But these people were crazy, and I was not prepared. But ultimately, I got comfortable with my voice, and I found my comfort zone. And what I realized is that one person telling a message that's grounded in truth can make a difference. One voice really does matter. I found that my voice mattered.